Words like incredible, unbelievable, mind-boggling are words that we use quite often in our world. Sometimes it's in a positive sense. There's an incredible performance, an unbelievable play, a mind-boggling end result. But they can also be used negatively. A terrible tragedy, a horrible happening, an awful accident. We hear about them on a weekly, if not a daily, basis. Sometimes both extremes happen almost simultaneously, as we will see in our text this morning. As we turn to Acts chapter 12, as we wrap up this part of our study of Evangelism 101, Lessons in Acts, we see some shifts in the landscape of the story of the early Christians. In those opening verses of Acts 12, we're introduced to the ugly reality of persecution. It was about this time that King Herod arrested some who belonged to the church, intending to persecute them. Now, this is not the King Herod of the Christmas story. That was Herod the Great. This is his grandson, known to history as Herod Agrippa the First. But he rose to power. Historian Paul Meyer says his rise to power reads better than a novel. And he was able to reestablish the kingdom of his grandfather. Herod Agrippa I was the son of Aristobulus, one of the sons of Herod the Great. And Aristobulus' mother was a woman named Mary Ann, who was the kind of the Jewish princess of that day. And Herod the Great had married her in a way to please the Jewish subjects. He himself was a descendant from Esau. And the Jewish people never really accepted him for that reason. Now, about 7 BC, Herod the Great had Aristobulus executed on suspicion of treason. He did that with a lot of his family. He executed a number of his sons who, in his paranoia, thought that they were trying to take the kingdom away from him, executed his favorite wife, Mary Ann, for the same reason. It got so bad that Augustus Caesar made the comment, "I'd rather be Herod's pig than his son." It's a wordplay in the Greek. Suos is pig and weos is son, or the other way around. But the idea was, if you were a pig, you wouldn't be slaughtered because they don't eat pork there in Judea. But if you were a son of Herod, your life might come to a sudden end. Agrippa's mother, seeing what was going on there, sent 4-year-old Agrippa off to Rome for safekeeping and to be raised there. By the way, Agrippa had a sister named Herodias. You may remember her. She was instrumental in having John the Baptist executed. So brother and sister here. When Agrippa got to Rome, he got to know some of the members of the royal family. In fact, he made some friendships with the grandnephew of Tiberius Caesar named Gaius, and another distant cousin named Claudius that was right around Agrippa's age. Now Gaius, who's better known to history as Caligula, eventually became emperor. And Agrippa was there in Rome as somewhat of an advisor. He didn't get too close to him because Caligula was crazy. And I mean that literally. He had completely lost his mind. The nickname Caligula literally means little boots. When he was a boy, his father dressed him up like a little Roman soldier, and the soldiers gave him the nickname Little Boots. As he got older, they started calling him Crazy Boots because that's really what he was. And it got so bad that just 4 years into his emperorship, his own bodyguards couldn't stand him and murdered him. And there was a gap in power at that time. They didn't have a normal succession. This Gaius did not have any children, so there wasn't anybody to step up. And Agrippa went to his friend Claudius, who was a distant relative, and said, "You need to step up. Rome needs you at this time." And he was instrumental working behind the scenes at getting Claudius to be the next emperor of Rome. Well, in gratitude, Claudius bestowed to Agrippa the title king and gave him the entire realm of his grandfather, Herod the Great. So Agrippa comes back to Judea. He sets up his throne initially in Jerusalem. The Roman governors had been in Caesarea, but he wanted to establish himself once again as the king of the Jews. And he wanted to build bridges. He was more diplomatic than any of the other members of the Herod's family. And he wanted to make a good impression on the Jewish leadership. So he found out what was something that he could do that would make their life a little easier and please them. And somebody must have told him about this pesky little cult that was following this teacher named Jesus of Nazareth. They were really causing problems there in Jerusalem, and maybe he could do something about it. And so he arrested one of the leaders of the church, a man named James. This is James, the son of Zebedee, brother of John, one of the inner circle of Jesus' disciples. And the passage here says that he had him put to death with the sword. That's a nice way the Bible uses that he was beheaded. And we see the first of Jesus' 12 apostles to lay down his life for his faith. You might wonder, why did he arrest James? I mean, why that one? It may have just been a matter of convenience. Maybe James was the first one they caught. We don't know. I have heard it said that James may have been the oldest of the 12 apostles. So maybe just by age, they assumed that he was the leader. We really don't know. We're not told a whole lot about James' execution. It's interesting, we read in great detail about Stephen, and he wasn't even one of the 12. And there's just barely a phrase about James. But the story of Stephen was instrumental in how the gospel went out. Not saying that James was unimportant or that his death didn't matter, but we're given just a very brief description of his passing. At any rate, James' death was good politics, as far as Agrippa was concerned. The Jewish leaders were very pleased by this, and so he said, "Well, let's try it again." And this time he gets Simon Peter. I don't know if he realized how important and influential Peter was. I think he probably got an inkling about who this guy was and perhaps his prior history. We're told that he put four squads of four soldiers each to guard him. Usually you just use one. Usually four guards is enough. You chain two to the prisoner and you put two outside the gate, you're set. He had 16. Maybe he had heard about what happened back in Acts chapter 5. When Peter and John had been arrested by the temple police, and in the middle of the night, an angel came and let them out. So Agrippa thought, well, we're going to make sure that doesn't happen again. So he gets 16 of the best Roman soldiers to guard this one prisoner. What this shows us, though, is that the ugly reality of persecution is just that. It's a reality. It's something Jesus himself predicted. In John 15, beginning in verse 18, he told his disciples, "If the world hates you, remember it hated me first. If you belong to the world, it would love you as its own. But as it is, you don't belong to the world. And that's why the world hates you. Remember the words I spoke to you. No servant is greater than his master. If they persecuted me, they will persecute you also." That makes sense, doesn't it? If you're going to persecute the leader, well, they're going to persecute the followers as well. And yet, It seems that whenever Christians fall under the hatred of the world, when people give us a hard time for our faith, we seem surprised. We're shocked. Why are they doing this to me? What did I do to them? I didn't. Why are they picking on me? We should expect it. In fact, if the world isn't giving us any trouble, maybe that should concern us more. Maybe they don't recognize that we're following Jesus. Maybe there's no difference, and that's why they're leaving us alone. Jesus said, if the world hates me, it's going to hate you too. If they persecuted me, they're going to persecute you too. And we've seen it throughout history. Not just in the first century, but all through the centuries, men and women and young people have given their lives because of their faith in Jesus Christ. I've mentioned in previous messages how that is right up to the present day. There were more Christians killed for their faith in the 20th century alone than in the previous 19 centuries combined. And it's continuing on into the 21st century, and it's getting closer to home. 1 week ago, we heard about a little church just like this, about our size. And a man with a gun came in and killed 26 of the worshipers. That was half of the congregation dead. While they worshiped, I did a little bit of research, and this is not, unfortunately, an isolated incident. It captured the headlines. It was the deadliest church shooting, but it wasn't the only one. There had been at least 18 church shootings in the United States between the years 1999 and 2010. In our country. And this last week, CBS News chronicled another 13 deadly attacks that they referred to as some of the fatal shootings that have happened at U.S. houses of worship over the last 5 years. It's happening more and more. Now, sometimes there's only one or two victims. Sometimes those victims aren't targeted because they're Christians or even because they're in church. That just happened to be the place that the shooter found them. But the idea is this: just because you are in a church building does not make you immune to the violence of our world. Just because you are a follower of Jesus does not mean that horrible things aren't going to happen to you. We are not immune. And I believe that as days go on and we get closer and closer to the end, it's going to get worse. We are going to see more and more of this persecution in our own nation. And we'd better be prepared for it. We might as well prepare ourselves in advance that it's going to happen, and we need to know what to do about it. So, what can be done? You see the church's response in the urgent request of prayer. Verse 5. So Peter was kept in prison, but the church was earnestly praying to God for him. Herod, as I said, saw how pleased the Jewish leaders were that he had executed James, so he gets his hands on Simon Peter. I'm sure that if he had his druthers, he would have just put him to death right away. But Luke tells us this was the Feast of Unleavened Bread. It was a Jewish holiday that lasted 7 days before Passover. And they had a law that you could not execute prisoners during this time. You say, well, wait a minute. They executed Jesus on Passover. That's true. But the Sanhedrin at that time broke a whole bunch of laws in executing Jesus. They didn't care. They had their hands on him. They wanted rid of him. Herod is trying to mend fences with the Jews. So he's going to abide by their laws. So he says, well, I'll just keep him in prison until after Passover, and then we'll take care of him. So the church is earnestly praying to God. Luke uses a Greek adverb here for earnestly. It's a very strong word. It speaks of agony. He actually uses the same word in his gospel when he's describing Jesus praying in the Garden of Gethsemane. Remember, it says that Jesus was praying so intently that he sweat great drops of blood. It's the same word used here. Now, I dare say this is not the way most of our prayer meetings go, is it? The few churches that still have prayer meetings anymore, number one, it's usually the lowest attended gathering of the week. And even as we come, I wonder sometimes how much actual time praying do we do? Now, there's nothing wrong with fellowshipping. There's nothing wrong with getting together and kind of catching up with each other. Nothing wrong with that. But how much actual time do we pray? And how earnest are we in our prayers? Unfortunately, it takes a tragedy like this or a horrible situation to bring us to our knees. Oh, then we're earnest in prayer. Oh, we'll spend hours in prayer. When it's a member of our family, when it's a member of our church family, when it's an attack on our country, oh, churches will be filled with people praying out to God. Isn't it sad that it takes something so devastating to bring us to where we ought to be? Notice, not only were they praying earnestly, many of them had gathered, and they came together. Adversity often unifies us. We forget about our little petty differences when we're coming together to pray. And that's what happened here. See, politically, they had no recourse. They couldn't appeal to the government because the government was the one doing the persecuting in this case. Militarily, they didn't have any weapons. What are they going to do? Go stage a jailbreak? There's 16 armed Roman guards. It's not going to happen. But that didn't mean they were without resource. As John Stott writes, prayer is the only power the powerless possess. When you feel that there's nothing else you can do, prayer is the best thing you can do. I often hear people come to me and say, well, I guess the only thing left to do is pray. That is the best thing you can do. Unfortunately, we tend to wait until the end. We use prayer as a last resort. Well, I've tried everything else. I guess I'll pray. That's kind of like putting together one of those toys on Christmas Eve, you know, for a child or a grandchild, and you've worked on it for 3.5 hours, and you say, I have tried everything. I guess I'll look at the directions, right? Prayer should never be a last resort. It ought to be our first response. And it is the best thing we can do for anybody. If someone is in need, pray for them. Keep praying for them. And that's what they did. God's power is released when people pray. You see the power of Satan at work through what Herod was doing, but when God's people prayed, he went to work. And you see the answer to their prayers in verses 6 to 11. The night before Herod was to bring him to trial, Peter was sleeping between two soldiers, bound with two chains, and sentries stood guard at the entrance. Can you imagine that? Here's Peter. Knows the next day he's going to be executed, and he's sound asleep. Didn't seem to bother him a bit. Suddenly, an angel of the Lord appeared and light shone into the cell. Remember, this middle of the night. Suddenly, he struck Peter on the side and woke him up. Quick, get up, he said. And the chains fell off of Peter's wrists. The angel said, put on your clothes and your sandals. And Peter did. Wrap your cloak around you and follow me. Peter followed him out of the prison, but he had no idea that what the angel was doing was really happening. He thought he was having a vision. Thought it was a dream. I mean, think about it. Middle of the night, bright light. Angel kicks Peter in the side and says, hey, get up. chains fall off of his wrist. He gets up, gets all his clothes and his coat on, and the soldiers haven't figured anything out yet. They didn't see anything. They didn't hear anything. It must have been 16 Sergeant Schultzes there. Can you imagine them standing before King Agrippa? I saw nothing. I heard nothing. Right? I don't blame Peter for saying, man, is this real? They walk out to the iron gates, and the gate opened up on its own. They didn't have those fancy door openers back then, but here it just opens up for them. Walks out into the street. They had walked the length of one street. I'm thinking that's about a block, and the angel disappears. Here's Peter standing in the middle of the street, middle of the night, wondering what is going on. Says when Peter came to himself and said, "Now I know without a doubt that the Lord sent his angel and rescued me from Herod's clutches and from everything the Jewish people were anticipating." I would call that the understatement of the chapter. Now, that's the amazing part. That's the miracle. That's the supernatural part of the story. But to me, the most intriguing part of the story is the unbelieving response of those Christians. There's an undercurrent of humor kind of throughout this story. I mean, you see it just a little bit in the escape, right? In the jailbreak. Let's continue reading from verse 12. When this had dawned on him, he went to the house of Mary, the mother of John, also called Mark, where many people had gathered and were praying. This is probably the same group Luke was talking about earlier in the chapter that were earnestly praying for Peter. Maybe they had an all-night prayer vigil, praying for Peter. Oh, they're praying earnestly. And suddenly, there's a knock at the door. So they sent one of the servant girls. I'm guessing she was probably a younger girl named Rhoda. Said, "Rhoda, go answer the door. Go see who that is." So she goes and she probably says, "Who's there?" "Simon Peter." She recognized his voice. And she's so excited that she runs back to tell the others. Problem is, she never opened the door. Left Peter standing out there. And remember, Peter's an escaped convict. At any moment, they're going to be searching the streets trying to find this guy. And he's left standing at the door. Rhoda goes back and says, hey, people, Peter's at the door. Now, you would expect these fine, upstanding Christians that have been praying all night would say, "Why, of course Peter's at the door. It's what we've been praying for. Let him in, of course." No, what do they say? "Ah, you're nuts. You're out of your mind." They don't believe her. She continues on. She says, "No, really, it's Peter." And somebody said, "Well, maybe it's his ghost. Maybe it's his spirit." Yeah, that must be what it is. There's a problem with that, though. Spirits don't have knuckles. And there's still this knocking on the door. Finally, he said, "Well, let's go see what's going on." And they, "What do you know? Wow, it's Peter." They're shocked. They're absolutely amazed that God did exactly what they were asking him to do. Isn't that pathetic? We can pray and pray and pray, and when God answers, we're like, "Ah, I don't believe it." Why? Why do we not believe that God answers prayer? I think it's a lot like that father that said to Jesus, "I believe, Lord, help my unbelief." Now, I'm not trying to be too hard on these Christians. Really, what I want to do with this is to encourage us. You don't have to have great faith for God to move. We do not have to be great men and women of faith for God to answer prayer. We simply need to have faith in a great God. That is where the greatness lies. And even if our faith is imperfect, even if we really kind of have doubts, as I'm going to pray, but I don't know if God's going to really answer it. Even that little bit of faith that might be so small, maybe the size of a mustard seed, it's all it takes. Don't wait until your faith is perfect, because it never will be. Bring your faith and say, Lord, I believe. Help my unbelief. And this is why I think it's important that we come together, because we can encourage each other in our faith and ask God for the impossible and rejoice when it happens. The people were all excited, and Peter had to hush them, and he told them what had happened. He said, now go tell James and the brothers. You say, wait a minute, I thought James was killed at the beginning of the chapter. Different James. That was James, the brother of John. This is James, the half-brother of Jesus, who was the head of the Jerusalem church at that time. And it says Peter went on to a different place, probably laid low for a while. He didn't leave Jerusalem entirely, because in chapter 15 he's very much a part of the Jerusalem council, but he just laid low for a while. You say, wow, that's a great story. What's it have to do with us? What in the world does it have to do with evangelism? I thought that's what this was all about. My application has to do with evangelism. Maybe we don't have a church leader that's locked up and about to be executed. But let's think of it in terms of those we know who don't know Christ. I want you to think for just a moment, is there somebody that you already know, maybe it's a family member, maybe it's a friend of yours or a neighbor or a work associate, whoever it might be, and they are so far away from God that you say it will take a miracle for them to ever accept Christ? Can you think of somebody like that? I'll bet every one of us can picture a person, at least one, that it would take a miracle for them to come to Jesus. God is in the business of miracles. And the greatest miracle he ever performed is not multiplying food to feed a multitude. It's not calming a storm on the sea. It's not even raising someone from the dead. The greatest miracle God ever performs is the transformation of a sinner's life who trusts in him. Will we believe God for that kind of miracle? Will we invest the time and the effort to pray for that kind of miracle? And I don't just mean little lip service and then we're off with our lives. Do you know that the average Christian spends 7 minutes a week in prayer? That's the average, which breaks down to 1 minute a day. And that might only be the time it takes to pray over your meals, right? For some people, that's the only time they pray. When are we going to get serious about prayer? And what is the greatest thing we can pray for? The salvation of souls. Get that list out that you made a long time ago of people that you already know that don't know Christ. And at the top of that, you wrote the words, my mission field. I challenge you to make that my prayer list. And pray for them. Pray for them earnestly. Pray for them expectantly and say, Lord, bring them to yourself, and if at all possible, use me to do it. Give me the opportunity, give me the words, give me the timing. Even if I'm just planting a seed that somebody else will later water and you make it grow, use me to bring people to Christ. because that is the greatest miracle we'll ever see. And I don't believe it's going to happen without prayer. And then when it does happen, don't be like those people that said, you're out of your mind. That couldn't be. Believe God to do the impossible. Nothing is too hard for Him. Now, you might have noticed that the title of this message is Exceedingly Abundantly. I took those words from Ephesians 3, 20 and 21, as I remember it in the King James Version. Now to Him who is able to do exceedingly abundantly above all we can ask or imagine, according to the power that is at work in us, to Him be glory in the church through Christ Jesus throughout all generations. Amen. Exceedingly abundantly, more than we can imagine, more than we can conceive, according to the power that's at work within us. Do you realize that the power that raised Jesus from the dead lives in you? Because it is the Spirit of God that raised Jesus lives in every believer. And if He can do that, He can use us to bring others to Christ. The question is, do we believe? Do we believe that God wants to use us to reach others for Him? Let's make that a matter of prayer. Let's make that a matter of faith. And pray that God would use us. I would not want us to be like the people of Nazareth, about whom it was written in Mark 6, and because of their unbelief, Jesus couldn't do any mighty miracles among them except to place His hands on a few sick people and heal them. And He was amazed at their unbelief. I wonder how many churches that bear His name, if Jesus would come, He would say, I'm amazed at your unbelief. And I'm sorry, but I'm only able to do so much. It's not that He can't, it's that He won't. It's like we had said in the story of Peter and Cornelius. Yes, God sent angels to Cornelius and Peter to bring them together, but God did not send an angel with the gospel to Cornelius. Why? Because He chooses only to work through humans. He's only going to work through us, but He's not going to work through us if we're not available. He's not going to work through us if we really don't believe. Will we believe? And will we allow God to do the impossible through us, that we might see lives changed and come to know Him? That is a question that only we can answer. And we're not going to answer it by coming forward at the end of a service. We're not going to answer it by making a promise to God. We're going to answer it by what we do. Are we going to start praying? Are we going to start watching for those opportunities? Are we going to start sharing our faith? That's what this whole series has been about. Learning lessons from these early Christians so that we can share faith on our own. This is the last message in this particular series. We may come back to it at a later date and pick up in chapter 13 with Paul and his ministry. I'm not sure. But I just want to emphasize once again how important it is that you and I get out there and bring people to Christ. And it's not that I'm trying to sell books, but there's a whole stack of books on the back table called Planting Seeds, Harvesting Souls. And if you're still not sure what it takes to bring somebody to Christ, get that book. and put it into practice so that we can do our job. You realize that's why we're here, right? So that we can bring others to Jesus Christ.